Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode. We have a massive feast for you today. We've got Zoe Vendetazzi talking about her book, Anywhere is Better Than Here. It's her debut novel, and it's been shortlisted for the Not the Booker Prize on the Guardian website. We also have Joe Sacco talking about comics and journalism and how those two things fit together. It's a really exciting interview with him. And we also have a chat with RJ Palacio, the author of Wonder. In June, you might remember, Wonder was featured on our book discussion podcast. You can tune into that. That features Emily Dodd, Rachel McCrum, and our own Sasha DeBoyle. We caught up with RJ Palacio at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, and we had a really, really good conversation about this incredibly heartwarming book for young adults, but I think that it also works for adults as well. Here she is, RJ Palacio.
It's about a 10-year-old boy named August Pullman, who in every single way possible is just an ordinary boy, except for the fact that he was born with this rather extraordinary face. He was born with a very severe craniofacial difference, which, you know, he's very aware of, and people are very aware of. And so the whole book is about how he has to navigate the world, a world that doesn't quite know how to face him. It's told from his point of view, and then it goes to alternate points of view, those of the kids that he encounters and his little circle of friends. So it's basically, on one hand, it's a book about how to deal with differences and what it's like to have a craniofacial difference, but really ultimately I see it as a meditation on kindness, on the impact of kindness in the world, and how one act of kindness can not only make someone's day, it could really change someone's life.
I mean, the facial features is a big point, but when I was reading it, the horrible qualities of middle school came rushing back. That is a terrible time. People are you have friends breaking up with you. Yeah. I can remember exactly the same thing that happened. Yeah. You know, my friend decided, no, we're not friends anymore.
Exactly. They drop you like, it's terrible. And I started writing Wonder when my older son was in the sixth grade. So he just finished fifth grade. And it was still very fresh in my mind. And when you're a parent, I think one of the things that happens is you relive a lot of those experiences that you thought you forgot forever. You kind of relive them through your own child. It can be really heartbreaking. Because here, as a parent, I'm trying to emphasize things like kindness and treat your friends with respect and all of these wonderful things. But I realized that not every other parent is prioritizing those same things with their kids. And so as a result, it's this kind of mix of things. You're telling your kid treat everybody really nicely, and not everyone else is telling their kids to do the same. So I guess I kind of wanted to write a book that reminded people that it's as important to stress those qualities, you know, kindness and empathy and compassion, as it is to stress academics and sports prowess and all that stuff that we tend to overstress, at least in the American school system. I don't know what it's like here, but I really just wanted to write a book that reminded people, especially other parents. It was a wink to other parents as well, just how important it is to remind because for some reason, I don't know what it is either, that parents have this, or a lot of parents, not all of them, but have this way of dismissing the behavior that the kids go through in middle school, you know, as if it's just a phase, like they expect every kid to go through a mean phase. And I just don't think that's acceptable. It's why? Why suddenly when you're 11 or 12 years old are you allowed to have a mean phase? I don't understand it.
Is that because it's just really hard to teach compassion?
I think so. And I think in a way you can't teach compassion, but my hope is that you can inspire it by having kids sort of take a moment to think about what it must be like to be in someone else's shoes. And I think one of the things that Wonder does is it invites children, readers, to explore what it must be like to be a kid with a craniofacial difference, or to be the friend of a kid with a craniofacial difference. You know, I think some readers read the book and they identify with Augie because he feels like an outsider. Some kids read the book and they identify with the children who react to Augie, and they kind of deep inside they think, okay, well, would I have been that nice girl who sat down with Augie on the first day of school, or would I have been more like Julian, the kid that's kind of bullies Augie throughout the school year, you know, or somewhere in between? Would I have been Jack, who's kind of forced into a friendship with Augie and ultimately becomes a really good friend, but he has to be pushed into it? The idea is that as a reader, you can kind of identify with a lot of different experiences.
There's a lot of different points of entry, and that's what I was going to ask. Was that a conscious decision to give that many, the different narrators, because that allows a lot of different ways of looking at this crystal?
Yeah, it really was. It was, you know, at a certain point when I decided to go into different voices, places it was a little scary, because as a writer, you know, you're always afraid of the sort of the thing that you're writing becoming a creature that becomes too crazy and gets beyond you, you know, and I was afraid that it might become unwieldy if I went into different voices. So I became very strict with myself and decided that if I did go into different voices, they would have to tell the same story. They couldn't deviate too much. And they had to, it would be like a relay race. They would, you know, you kind of pass a baton on to the next character, and then they tell more of the story and so on. But it would always have to be about Augie. And so that was sort of the narrative that I stuck to.
And Augie's voice is so strong. It must have been quite scary to even just start to play along with other kids who are speaking. Because the language of children is such an interesting thing, and you do it so well.
It is. And people have asked me, like, how, you know, I seem to have gotten the language right. And I think it's because I eavesdrop really well. It's funny because my husband complains about the fact that I always, you know, we go to a beach and I always end up wanting to move, and because he doesn't hear.
Wanting to move so you could hear other people better.
No, wanting to move because I can't stop hearing other people's conversations. I want to be more private. It's this problem I have. I just eavesdrop all the time. And I think it suited me because ultimately writing is about eavesdropping and listening to what people or how they sound and what they're saying and what they're not saying, you know. And so I'm constantly eavesdropping on kids' conversations when I go to my son's school. I can't help it. And then I try to capture that on the pages.
Yeah, did you do any research, or was it just from your own experience?
No, I didn't. Oh, the part I researched was about genetics and craniofacial differences, because that I didn't have any firsthand knowledge about. So I did have to research a lot of the, you know, what it must be like. I mean, I used my imagination for much of it, because I think much of writing is really extrapolation. You find the universal feelings that we all feel about being an outsider, and you tap into that, but then you can only extrapolate what it must be like to be a boy like Augie, or to be the mother of a boy like Augie. What inspired me to write the book was actually a very brief encounter I had. I was with my two sons. My younger son was about 3 years old, and we were in front of an ice cream store. We were sitting on a bench waiting for my older son to come back outside with the chocolate milkshakes, and I realized that sitting right next to me was a little girl with a very severe craniofacial difference. And my younger son was only 3 at the time, was in a stroller facing me. He hadn't seen her yet, but I knew that the moment he looked up and saw her, and we were so close to her, that he would probably start to cry or scream or react in some way that might hurt her feelings. And I was so kind of keenly aware of wanting not to hurt her feelings that I think what I did was ultimately made it worse, because I kind of got up rather quickly and tried to start sort of like, you know, kind of wheeling him away in the stroller before he would react. But unfortunately, he did react, and everything I thought would happen did happen. He started to cry, and then my older son came out of the store, and it was a scene. And I kind of tried to push my sons away from the scene as quickly as possible, again, trying to spare this little girl her feelings. But I think my reaction ultimately made it worse. What I wished I'd had the wherewithal to do was to, of course, I mean, now it seems so obvious, I should have simply turned to the little girl and started a conversation with her and shown my sons that there was nothing to be afraid of, that there was nothing to fear, and used it as a teaching moment. You know, we're always, as parents, we're always looking for teaching moments where you can kind of teach your children by example what to do and how to respond, and instead I responded stupidly. And anyway, it was that incident that really got me thinking about what it must be like for that little girl and her family. I mean, what it must be like to have to get up every day and face a world that doesn't know how to face you back. And once I started thinking about it, I really so regretted the way I responded that day. I was so disappointed in myself. And I initially started writing Wonder that night.
Because you can't go back, right? You can't go back. Do that, and those things are playing out in your head. I just did this.
Oh, exactly. And as I was leaving, even after, you know, I was only about half a block away, I was thinking, I should go back and apologize. I should go back. But I just didn't. Do something. And I just could not. But what really broke my heart that particular day is that as I was pushing the stroller away, and again, my 3-year-old's crying, my older son, who at the time was about 11, was just, you know, dumbfounded. So I'm leaving, and I heard the little girl's mom say in as calm and sweet a voice as you could possibly imagine, "Okay, girls, I think it's time to go." And she's and I realized, oh my goodness, she's been through it a million times. You know, she's seen it all. She wasn't even mad at me. I think she was understanding of the situation, and it was just, I don't know, something about her voice and a weariness and a kindness, a compassion in her voice that just really got to me as a mom.
Yeah, and this acceptance of the situation, which is so awful.
Exactly, and that was more than anything what really started me thinking about this whole, you know, again, Wonder kind of, I really did start that night. I started also because that very night I heard the song Wonder by Natalie Merchant, which had always been one of my favorite songs, and I guess I'd never really listened to the lyrics before, though, because I must have sung that song a million times to my older son when he was a little baby. It was my lullaby song for him. It's about a child being born who has severe differences and challenges, and how with love and with patience and with faith she'll make her way in the world. And I just, it was something about the song and the situation that had just happened to me earlier in the day that made me think, okay, well, this is, I'm going to write a book, and it's going to be called Wonder, and it's going to be about a kid who has to deal with this. And I started writing that night. I didn't know where it would go, and that's it.
You must get really interesting, I don't know, discussions, communications, letters from young kids who read this book. Do you get?
I've been getting a lot, and of course, the most amazing ones, the majority of the ones that I get are from kids who say that after reading it, you know, it kind of made them want to be kinder people, which is pretty nice, considering, you know, you're talking about 5th and 6th and 7th graders or 10 to 14-year-olds, that they're actually thinking about these things. But I do get a whole other group of emails from kids or parents of kids who actually have craniofacial differences and who have really, really responded to the book in this wonderful way. You know, it's not only because they identify with Augie or the parents of Augie, it's because they understand that it's a way of creating dialogue with people around the world about how to treat their children, you know, how to treat them, how to see them. It's a chance for people to actually think a little bit about how to respond to somebody if they were ever to see someone who looks like Augie. They know from reading the book, hopefully, that, you know, not to do what I had done, which is to run away. But just, you know, they're normal people. Just go up to them, say hi, you know, and treat them well.
And do you get letters from parents as well? Yeah, you do hear from. It must be really intense. Is it ever?
Some of them are really intense. I've gotten one letter from a 91-year-old woman. She said she read the story and she was reminded of an incident that happened to her in a lunchroom when she was 11 years old. And, you know, and I use that letter a lot. I've asked for permission, but when I talk to kids in schools, I talk about that letter because, you know, it reminds them that, you know, 8 decades later, this woman is still remembering an extraordinary act of unkindness that happened to her in a lunchroom when she was 10 years old. And it really brings it home for the kids because they realize, well, you know, oh, I can either be remembered for being a nice person, or I could be remembered for being a jerk, you know, in a lunchroom. And which do you prefer? And I think when they see it that way, I think they kind of realize that the importance of their actions. They really have a chance to think about what they want, the fact that they are noticed and they are remembered, and what they do actually matters in a way that maybe sometimes they don't realize when they're 11 years old, you know, that their actions do sort of get remembered, and they will be remembered for the things they do.
RJ Palacio, everybody. Her book, Wonder, is available everywhere. Really fantastic to catch up with her. Also fantastic to hear her talk about her book after listening to our great discussion from Rachel, Sasha, and of course, Emily Dodd, who were all on the June podcast, just having a little bit of a book discussion. Tune into that if you want to hear more about people's opinions on Wonder. And also make sure to subscribe to our podcast. You can get all of these right into your iTunes inbox every time we release a new episode of Book Talk. Up next, we have Joe Sacco. Joe Sacco, I've been a big fan of his work for a number of years, and I was really excited to hear he was going to be coming to the Edinburgh International Book Festival as part of the kind of stripped program, which was focusing on graphic novels, comic books, illustrated work, whatever you want to call it. Joe Sacco is a total pioneer in terms of combining journalism with kind of drawn art, comics art, whatever you want to call it. He's a great illustrator, a really, really thoughtful journalist, and it was fascinating to get his opinions on how journalism and comics work together. His latest book is called Journalism, which is a selection of his journalistic works that have appeared in magazines over the past years. Here he is, Joe Sacco.
My name's Joe Sacco. I guess my newest book is called Journalism.
Journalism is a collection of older pieces from magazines and things, and it's drawn for people who don't know you. I guess what do you call yourself? Do you consider yourself a journalist or an illustrator?
I consider myself a cartoonist that has worked in the journalism field. You know, most of my comics have been journalistic, but I still think of myself as a cartoonist because I might want to branch out, do other things. You know,
I really admire the way that I'm able to get into the story and the stories that you tell, which have a bit of a travelogue element because it's so much with your personality. Because you talk a lot about subjectivity and objectivity,
right,
and the notion that there's this objectivity, especially because I went to journalist school, right? And one of the things that frustrated me immediately was this notion of objectivity. But of course, you have to leave certain things out. And I think the way you portray journalism, which is going in and doing it, and we get to see your process of experiencing these things and the people you talk to, I guess it could be considered subjective.
Well, I don't think of myself as being objective. By the standard journalistic definition, I consider myself being honest. Maybe one way of putting it is I report objectively those things I choose to report on. I might choose, I mean, I'm not one of those people who's like constantly looking to find two sides to the story and finding the truth in the middle. That seems to be standard American-style journalism is basically to present both sides and let the reader come to his or her own conclusions. I would think the reader would want more from someone if they trust that person in the field to report back what's actually going on. Because sometimes the truth doesn't reside in the middle. And that's something that I'm completely comfortable saying and I'm comfortable living with. But I don't think I hide that notion from my readers. I think it's clear that my work is subjective on that particular level. I hope they think my reporting is honest about whatever I have decided to report on from whatever side I'm trying to look at things from.
Right, because you're not embellishing quotes or anything like that. The text that we're reading
Why would I? I mean, there's no reason to embellish quotes. I mean, truth is always more just as interesting as any fabrication could possibly be.
Do you find that like going in as a cartoonist gives you a bit more freedom compared to other reporters?
I think other reporters are just as free as I am to go and do the sorts of stories I've done. You know, sometimes there are journalists who go and they spend time at a place and they sink into a place, and I think it's done. I'm not an originator in that sense. I think I tend to have more freedom just because I'm usually not beholden to a editor in some other Western city who's asking for the story's going that way. We're watching CNN and this is going on. Why aren't you reporting that too? I don't have that problem. I think a lot of reporters would prefer to have a little more freedom about what they report just because they sort of know the stories better, I think.
Yeah, I'm wondering actually how, because this is something that I was thinking about the other day, was how fast is it? Because it is to draw the story as well as to tell get the facts right and all of these things. It seems like you're on a much longer time frame in terms of gathering the information and then releasing it. And that must give you a little bit more time to let it sit.
Well, I mean, there's a certain amount of frustration in how long it can take me to do a story. But I've learned to live with that and realize a lot of stories I'm telling have a universal component. I mean, they're very about a specific place in a specific time, but that many human characteristics are common from time to time. And unfortunately, in some cases, a situation doesn't change all that much, let's say for the Palestinians. But it does take a long time to do this sort of work. And other cartoonists might be faster, but I'm not. I'm very detail conscious. So my work, I just consider it slow journalism. It's slow when I'm there because I just take my time about getting the story. I usually, not always, but usually I allow myself a fair amount of time to get a story. I have to take the time to draw it properly, and that can take years. So current events are no longer exactly current, but I think they're still universal.
Well, yeah, I think so. And a lot of what you deal with, I mean, along the themes, I mean, I'm thinking specifically about the surprise I felt when I read your Malta piece. It's about immigrants coming from Africa and living in Malta and the kind of challenges they're meeting from the government and from the local populace. Were you surprised about finding that story?
Well, I knew it was going to be there. I mean, you do enough research to know that there's a problem there, but there's a problem throughout Europe. There's a problem in the United States. There's a problem in Australia. There's a problem around the world, it seems, or there's a question of what do you do with people who no longer want to live where, for whatever reasons, where they're living. And sometimes the reasons are damn good, and you would move too if you're under the same conditions. So I knew the story existed there. I chose purposely to go there to report that particular story. I didn't just find it while I was there. You know, I wanted to go. I set it up. I did a lot of research about Maltese government policy, for example, before I went. I set up my interview, a lot of my interviews before I went. You know, so it was pretty planned out.
It's amazing reading the quotes from the Maltese government.
Yeah, and you know, it's they're not flattering. They're not. It's not about self-flattery, certainly, but he was being very clear, and I appreciate that in a certain sense, because you know where you stand with someone like that.
Yeah.
He's basically saying they need to move on.
And they had it. I mean, this is the thing, and because of the context that you place it in, you know, where we are getting a very full story of the struggle of getting out of Africa, ending up in Malta. I mean, these people were on, they thought they were going to die on the boat. What was it? They gave them a can of petrol and just said, go.
Right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, they were given the rough direction, how to steer, how to keep the rudder, and then it was just up to them to get there. And, you know, at some point, they're overdue. They think they should have landed by now. They're running out of everything. And they see any land they're going to land. It might not be Italy. It doesn't matter. It's just they want to keep their lives, you know, and they're going to land where they can land.
It's that kind of empathy that I think really attracts me to the work that you do. And I wonder how hard that is for you as an artist to convey that and the sense of responsibility you must feel in terms of presenting this information to people.
As a journalist, you need to keep some distance. As a human being, that can be almost impossible. You know when they know that you're going to move on. But obviously, you know, when they wonder what good it's going to do, it can be hard to come up with an answer that seems satisfying to you or for them. I mean, if I say, well, you're an example of this, then I'm going to tell people about it. Well, how does that help me personally? And there's never a good answer for that.
You don't sketch while you're there, do you?
I seldom sketch while I'm in the field, so to speak. Though I do on occasion when it's appropriate to sketch and not appropriate to take a photograph.
You said you were going to moving away from kind of going into the hot zones of war areas and troubled areas.
I am probably moving away from hot zones specifically. I might go to someplace, who knows? I mean, I never say never, but I'm never going to move away from politics.
Hmm.
I can't. I'm interested in how human nature affects politics. I'm interested in how psychology affects politics. I want to see things somehow holistically and not separate things out so much. And I'm not sure where that's going to lead or how I'm going to convey it, but I'm kind of learning mode right now.
You realize you're struggling to figure out the motivations of people.
That's accurate. I'd like to find out what motivates people, why people do the things they do, often on behalf of a state. I'm curious how that all works, and I'd like to take a step back from nationalism and patriotism and think about maybe the science of it and the methodology of it. How state structures exist to make us think a certain way. And it might not even be all planned out, but, you know, school, church, everything sort of gears you toward a certain way of thinking, which is often in alliance with how the dominant powers want you to think anyway. So that's what I'm interested in, sort of larger picture of why people behave the way they behave.
But I think that's something that's really exciting about your work is that it does do that personal thing, but it also zooms out in a really good way to give you an overview. I'm particularly impressed by your work in Palestine, and I was impressed by the way that you started to do that work.
I went because I wanted to do a comic series about where I was going, which was the Palestinian territories, but I didn't really know what I was doing or how I was going to go about it. I mean, I had ideas of what I might be doing, but it was very unclear in my mind.
And what happened? What changed it to make it a little bit more clear?
Well, having studied journalism, just when I was talking to people, I realized, oh, I'm taking notes. I'm trying to get their quotes. I just behaved naturally like a journalist would. And then you begin thinking of it as a story. And, well, I've seen this aspect of life under occupation. What are the other major elements of life under occupation? Oh, I should talk to someone who's had their home demolished. Oh, I should talk to people who've been detained without charges. I mean, you begin to sort of see the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle as a journalist might. And just because I'd studied that, I guess, and then I behaved that way.
And then at the same time, was producing a comic book, essentially, right? You were doing a serialized comic.
Yeah, after that, I started doing a serialized comic. And it was probably the Bosnia book that really got me, the Safe Area Garage, that got me a bit more directed in how I was doing my work. And then, of course, people are asking me questions all the time about my work. So what used to be sort of inherent and natural now becomes sort of theory, if you know what I mean.
Your next project is, you're working on a piece on World War One.
Yes, I have a book coming out about the First World War, and it's already finished, and it's coming out in Great Britain mid-October and in the United States in early November.
And it sounds really cool. It's not a book.
It's a long illustration. It's a fold-out illustration, one continuous drawing, and there are no words.
How did it feel to not have words?
It was kind of enjoyable just to draw, to be honest.
Joe Sacco, everybody, thanks to him for making the time to chat with us. It was a really, really busy August in Edinburgh, and it was really nice that he took the time to sit down. You can get his book, Journalism. It's really a fantastic read, and I highly recommend it. And speaking of festivals, the Dundee Literary Festival is coming up very, very soon. We're really pleased to have on our podcast Peggy Hughes, who is the director of the Dundee Literary Festival. And she's going to give you guys some exciting events you might miss if you don't get a chance to see the program. Definitely make your way up to Dundee to check out what's going on there. It's a very exciting program. Here she is, Peggy Hughes.
Hello, my name is Peggy Hughes, and I'm the programme director of the Dundee Literary Festival. I also work on several projects throughout the year, including our literary salons, New Writing Dundee, and other spontaneous, lovely bookish projects in Dundee. But today I'm here to tell you Book Talk listeners a little bit more about the Dundee Literary Festival and some events that I think might especially appeal. The Dundee Literary Festival runs from Wednesday 23rd October until Sunday the 27th, and we have events that will suit every taste, every genre, every pocket. With 40 plus events happening in the heart of Dundee, I hope you'll come along and join us. On Sunday the 27th of October at 1 p.m, you can come along and join us and Dundee's new macker, W.N. Herbert, aka Bill, and his co-editor, Andy Jackson. Together they worked on a book called Whaleback City, Poems of Dundee and Its Hinterlands, and they're going to be telling us a bit more about the editorial process and reading some beautiful poems from and of Dundee. That's only a bargain, it's £5 and includes a sandwich and a lovely cup of tea, so I hope you'll come along and probably find out more about what Bill's got planned as our new macker. On Sunday evening, we're going to be joining with some Canongate authors, Matt Haig and Richard Holloway, and Canongate's publishing director, Francis Bickmore, just to toast this brilliant, rebellious, wonderful publishing institution, Canongate Books, on their 40th birthday, to raise a glass to 40 more years. We've got the wonderful Sarah Hall. She's appearing with us twice at the festival, once on Thursday the 24th, with equally fabulous novelist and short story writer Ruth Thomas, and they're going to be speaking about their creative practices specifically as novelists and short story writers in an event called The Long and the Short of It. But we've also got Sarah Hall joining us with fellow Granta Best of Young British Novelist Jenny Fagan. They're going to be speaking a bit more about being the bright young things of our literary scene just now and about their novels and their latest books. And they're both going to be fabulous events with fabulous company. We've got William McIlvany, the crime writer's crime writer, the godfather of all. He's going to be speaking about his Laidlaw books, which have just been reissued by Canongate, and we're really excited to see Willie McIlvany. I mean, the godfather of tartan noir. We're so excited to have him with us. Speaking of crime, we've got plenty of crime going on at this year's festival. We've got Denise Miner and Doug Johnson, and they're going to be speaking about the crime in the East and West. Denise Miner, who unprecedentedly has taken the Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year twice in a row, as well as being the owner of the best hair in Scottish literature, probably. And they're going to be speaking about their new books. We've also got Douglas Skelton and Quentin Jardine on for you crime fans. This year, we've got a fabulous festival hub with stalls from local Dundonian creative makers and crafters, all sorts for all tastes, and victuals for the hungry supplied by Ms. Battenberg's travelling tea room. So lots of seasonal pies and lovely soups, and we hope that you'll come along and hang out with us as well as attend some of our events. If, though, you can't come to the festival in October, I hope you'll follow along online. You can find us on Twitter at Literary Dundee, and the hashtag for the festival is Dundee Lit Fest, and search for us on Facebook as Literary Dundee. We'll be posting pictures and chat and images. And if you can't make it for our festival, then do check out our work year-round. You can find out more about that at www.literarydundee.co.uk. Keep an eye out for our salons, which happen at Dundee Central Library, for Hotchpotch, which is an open mic night in Dundee, and also for the work of our pals and creative partners at Creative Dundee, the DCA, and others. It's a really brilliant city. We'd love to see you coming along and joining in the book fun in Dundee.
Thanks very much, Peggy. To get an idea of the full program, go visit literarydundee.co.uk. And if you're in Dundee around October, do drop in to the Dundee Literary Festival. It should be great. Sounds really exciting. Somebody who has a really strong connection to Dundee and who I met when I was invited up to take part in one of her literary salons there is Zoe Vendetazzi. Her debut novel came out last year. It's called Anywhere is Better Than Here. It's been getting some attention because it was shortlisted for the Not the Booker Prize in The Guardian. And here she is to tell you a little bit about her book and her work is Zoe Vendetazzi. This is your first novel, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah. It's about a young woman, sort of mid-20s, who lives with a crummy boyfriend. Well, she thinks he's crummy. Actually, he's okay, but she's just horrible about him. She has a job that she hates. She doesn't really know where her life's going. And at the beginning of the book, she runs out of her flat at night, very melodramatically, and ends up meeting an older guy who's quite troubled. And the two of them start a kind of an affair and end up on the run with a teenager. It's really about how, I guess anybody, but particularly women, have all the choice in the world available to them, but still often make the same rubbish choices with men. And also things like careers, like, you know, who am I, what am I good at, sort of thing. So she's at a point in her life where she really has no idea what she's doing with her life and ends up making a series of quite poorly informed choices.
And what was it about this character that you were attracted to, and what was it about these situations that you found yourself drawn into?
I think one of the main sort of background ideas in the book is about the fact that Laurie, the girl, is dealing with grief, but she's not dealing with it properly. It's in the back of her head, and that's one of the things that makes her sort of reluctant to move on into adult life, is that she's dealing with who somebody died and she can't face it properly. So I'm really interested in that because my dad died just before I wrote the book. So I found that, you know, kind of an interesting area to kind of look at and write about. But I think the thing I like the most about Laurie is she's somebody who lives in her head and has got a very odd, at times, take on life. She fantasizes a lot about there having been some sort of apocalyptic event and that everybody else is dead and it's just her and what she would do under those circumstances. And that's something that I spend a disproportionate amount of time thinking about as well. Not so much talking about, but thinking about. So I just found that quite interesting, the fact that we've all got these weird thoughts in our own minds and that other people don't necessarily know that then informs how we interact with other humans. This is a bit at the beginning of the book where the main character, Laurie, has melodramatically escaped her house and goes to an old man's pub. There were three others in the bar, two old guys sitting 6 feet apart against the back wall under a big uncovered strip light, and a torn-faced barmaid behind the counter, rag in hand. She was so heavily tanned that she looked like one of those bog people that archaeologists seem to dig up from time to time. Laurie moved over towards the table and realised that she'd need to approach the bar to get a drink. She turned again and walked over to the woman. "Can I have a pint of lager, please?" The woman looked at her again, moved silently to the taps, poured a pint, placed it in front of Laurie and gave her a long look. £2. The voice was flat. She held out her hand. Laurie stared at it for a moment, taking in the array of gold rings. Were these remains from the medieval times? She could picture the hand, beringed and filthy, reaching out from the ground to a group of eager young archaeologists. The woman jabbed her hand at Laurie. £2. Okay, I just have to... Laurie had to search her pockets and make up the money in stray change. By the time she looked up again with the money, the woman had turned her back and started to rearrange the crisps. Laurie put the £2 on the counter and made her way back to the booth through the mismatched chairs and tables. She sat down and took off her coat whilst glancing around. What kind of place was this? It was bereft of any Christmas decorations. The walls were a patchy white and the plaster was crumbling in places. The floor had two different types of lino that overlapped here and there, causing swells and dips. The barmaid had turned and was now staring at a spot above and to the left of Laurie's head. The door opened and a heavy-set young man in a polo neck walked in and headed straight to the bar. "Pint, Mags." The barmaid grinned at the man. "How are you tonight, Jerry?" One of Bogface's eye teeth was missing. He shrugged, picked up his pint and sat at the table nearest Laurie's with his back to the bar. The transformation in the barmaid was astonishing. She smiled as she scoured her cloth across the bar, and one of her shoulder straps had fallen to reveal even more of her preserved skin. Laurie looked back down from the bar to surreptitiously check out this Jerry. He was smiling at her. "How'd you like it?" He cut through the air with an upturned palm. "What?" she smiled. "The pub or the atmosphere?" "Ah, both. Everything." She laughed for the first time that day. "Jerry." He reached across to shake her hand. Laurie glanced up at the bar in time to see the barmaid's face fold shut. Her peak gave Laurie confidence. At least she was a better prospect than the old hag. "Laurie," she smiled, "would you like to join me?" He moved across to her table. "So what are you doing here?" He took a big drink of his pint. You on the run? She smiled. Was she? She supposed she was. But how pathetic to be on the run from someone like Ed. Sort of, she sipped her beer. Yourself? You escaping something? Ugh, cheap beer, snazzy decor, on the way home from work? He nodded as he spoke. Where is it you work? The hospital. He paused and pointed at himself. I am a hospital DJ. Really? I've never met anyone who did that. Is it interesting? He thought for a moment. Ugh, I'm thinking about leaving, actually. He smiled brightly at Laurie. Anyway, do you want another drink? Laurie looked down at her almost full glass. Jerry smiled. Well, how about a nip? She shrugged. Why not, eh? Jerry turned to the bar. Laurie took the opportunity to check him out a bit more. He was taller than Ed, taller than her dad, maybe about 6 foot-ish, manly, looked like he could cut things down and carry stuff around. He was wearing a thick, dark green woolly jumper, which should have looked daggy, but actually just looked warm and practical. His shoulders had that nice straight line to them that some men had. Ed would never have shoulders like that. He'd never be manly like this guy. Mags, my darling, two nips and a pint when you have a moment. The barmaid narrowed her eyes, no doubt contemplating poisoning either one or both of the drinks.
Well, I thought it would be a good idea, maybe, or interesting to hear your top five books.
Well, I think the first one would probably be The Edible Woman by Margaret Atwood. And if you're familiar with that book, it was written in the 60s and it's quite kind of like an early kind of feminist book. My book character, Laurie, is like a modern day version of the girl in that book, Marion. Love that book. Love Margaret Atwood. She's like my kind of guiding light. I think also Jesus Son by Dennis Johnson. Those short stories are amazing. I don't know that I can necessarily write like him, but I think that they're a really great guide about something that's funny and dark and weird and unexpected and also beautiful at times. I love them. And for exactly the same reasons, although less weird and dark, Lives of Girls and Women by Alice Munro, who of course is another great heroine because she's just amazing. 100 Pieces for the Left Hand by J. Robert Lennon, who I think is a sort of a criminally underknown writer. He's a fantastic writer and he's written lots of novels, but his book, 100 Pieces of the Left Hand, is really interesting because it's 100 really short stories. They're kind of loosely all happening in one place and there's a narrator that comes in and out of them, but you can read them all separately or together. And what I like about that is it's the voice, but also that he brought out a CD at the same time that was 100 really short pieces of music that kind of went with it. He's amazing. He's totally cool. And then finally, I think a book that I've just finished and I really enjoyed, which is May We Be Forgiven by A.M. Holmes. I don't know if you asked me in 2 months if that would still be my top five. It's because I've just finished it. But I think A.M. Holmes is just so cool. I love the way she writes. I would write in a sort of a similar sort of a vein one day when I'm a grown up like her. That's what I'd like to be like. Her stories are, you know, sort of human and you empathise, but they're also weird and stuff happens that you go, oh, I really wasn't expecting that. And there's occasional bits of violence and good swearing and, you know, it's sarcastic and dry. And I just really, really enjoyed that book. I thought it was brilliant.
That's Zoe Venditazzi, everybody. Her book is Anywhere is Better Than Here. Thanks very much to her for sitting down with us. And thanks again to all the people who appeared on our podcast today. That includes Joe Sacco. His book is Journalism. And RJ Palacio, whose book is called Wonder. All fine, fine books. Really pleased to have them all on the podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show for today. We'll be back in your ears very, very soon. Remember, if you want to find out more about the Scottish Book Trust and what we do, visit us on www.scottishbooktrust.com. You can also like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @ScottishBKTrust. We'd love to have a conversation with you. But until next episode, keep reading, and we'll see you soon. Book Talked is produced by Colin Fraser with music from Ragland.